Union Major Robert Anderson arrived in Charleston in late 1860 to take command of nearby Fort Moultrie. He was deeply afraid that war was near. In a letter, quote, "The storm may break upon us at any time," quote. And then he asked Washington for special instructions as, quote, "My position here is rather a politico-military than military one," quote. In a second report, nearly 1 week later, Anderson indicated he feared attack at Moultrie and was laying plans to garrison both Castle Pinckney and Fort Sumter. Both were still empty. Now, as this map indicates, the harbor was surrounded by fortifications. To the north, on a slim point of land at the end of Sullivan's Island, was Fort Moultrie. To the south of the shipping channel, Fort Johnson and Cumming Point provided vantage points guarding Charleston. Fort Johnson was empty, and Cumming's Point became a maneuvering ground for South Carolina militia and Citadel cadets. In the middle of these three sites was the island fortress of Fort Sumter. To the east, towards Charleston, stood Castle Pinckney and the battery at Charleston itself. Anderson considered all these forts his responsibility, and by early December his crews were busy at both Sumter and Castle Pinckney. Anderson encouraged his officers to work double shifts to get the forts ready in what he called just in case. But Anderson also withheld his final plans from his officer corps. Anderson continued to ask Washington for advice and reinforcements. Unfortunately, for all of November, December, and January, the federal government was incapable of action. President James Buchanan, known as Old Buck, was a good diplomat in his time, but was unable to act amid the growing crisis. In Charleston, rumors and anger grew as work on the forts continued. Washington sent Major Don Carlos Buell to investigate the Charleston situation. Although ordered to give Anderson only verbal messages, Buell did place a general order in writing. If Anderson had, quote, "tangible evidence of a design to proceed to a hostile act," then and only then could he move his garrison to another fort. In early December, Anderson met with Charleston officials to ask that authorities prevent mob violence against Moultrie. Charleston leaders agreed, but defiantly requested that the forts be turned over to them. On December 20, the South Carolina Convention voted for secession. Fireworks were set off and taverns were kept open as the city celebrated. Only 4 miles away, the soldiers in Fort Moultrie could hear the cheerleading. As Christmas 1860 neared, Anderson began to reveal his plans to boldly move his garrison to Fort Sumter. The fort was designed in about 1827, and it was there to provide crossing fire with Fort Moultrie to any invading ship coming up the channel. The fort supported 140 guns and up to 1,000 men. The cannons were designed to have a top row of guns out in the open for maximum elevation. This is known as imbabaretto, and two lower rows of guns in protective bomb-proof encasements, which could be fired horizontally through small openings known as embrasures. The south side was weakest and was designed to take on supplies from Charleston. December 26, in 40-degree weather, Anderson made his move. He had told the men he was moving women and children and extra supplies to Fort Johnson for safekeeping. This diversion covered the mustering of boats and supplies. After dodging patrol boats for several hours, the garrison was relocated without a major hitch. The next morning, Charleston and the rest of the country awoke to a major crisis. Emissaries from newly elected South Carolina Governor Francis Pickens met with Anderson the next day to demand that Anderson withdraw. Anderson refused. At noon that day, December 27, 1860, Anderson ordered a large American flag raised over Fort Sumter on a tall mast-like flagpole. The city was livid, and war talk continued. Charleston militia gathered at the Citadel and later took possession of Castle Pinckney and Fort Moultrie. These actions by Pickens in South Carolina assumed that Washington would send naval vessels to Fort Sumter immediately, but that was not the case. General Winfield Scott had indeed been planning such a possibility, but had to locate a steamer suited for the purpose. He located the Star of the West in early January. The ship was hired to go to Fort Sumter, and in those days, no such hire could be kept secret. Even the Charleston papers carried speculation about when and where the Star of the West would appear. The Star sailed into Charleston Harbor January 9, but she was spotted by patrol boats as well as by a group of Citadel cadets camping on Morris Island south of Cummings Point. The cadets fired. The Star made matters worse by raising an American flag, hoping to signal Anderson. The cadets fired several more times. Afraid that Moultrie would open fire as well, the Star returned to sea and to New York. Anderson, seeing a federal ship being fired upon, hesitated but did not fire. He and his men were stuck. They became virtual prisoners for over 3 months. Anderson wrote of those days, "I feel like a sheep tied watching the butcher sharpening his knife to cut his throat." 2 days after the Star incident, Governor Pickens sent emissaries to again demand return of the fort. Anderson again refused. Other emissaries were sent to Washington without results. February and March were miserable days at the fort. Supplies became scarce. More men reported sick. The tensions with the city continued to elevate. Governor Pickens was presented with several plans for attacking the fort, but all of them had only one conclusion. Sumter was a strong fortification, and any attack would take men, materiel, cannon, ammunition, and most preciously, money. South Carolina and Charleston had little to spare. Now, meanwhile, both sides planned. Sumter soldiers built covered mines of sorts across the fort's entrance. The entire wharf was also mined. Anderson also ordered firing boxes to be built on the top of the fort along the parapets to allow soldiers to fire down on attackers. Despite hostilities, a few fresh supplies did reach the fort. In early February, the Confederacy was officially created and Jefferson Davis sworn in as president. Davis sent advisors to Fort Sumter to assess the readiness of the Charleston batteries. He received a report harshly critical of the preparations to take Fort Sumter. As a result, Davis appointed Pierre Gustave Beauregard as brigadier general and sent him to Charleston. Beauregard had been a student and a friend of Anderson's at West Point. He quickly organized the forces around Sumter to provide what he termed a ring of fire. In March, President Lincoln sent several emissaries to Sumter. Anderson was encouraged. At least these men were directly from the president. Anderson told his visitors that his few remaining barrels of flour and other staples might last until April 10, but that something would have to be done soon. Ward Hill Lyman, a business partner of Lincoln's, had even hinted at evacuation aboard civilian vessels when he talked with Governor Pickens. Lincoln wrote Anderson that relief was on the way. Then Lincoln very ungraciously ordered Anderson to remain at his post, fearing that he might cave in and give in to the South Carolinians. Another Union post commander in Texas had recently done just that. Anderson had no intention of leaving, and he was forever saddened by the note from Lincoln. But on April 10, fearing Lincoln's relief effort was near, and desiring to strike first, Davis ordered Beauregard to demand the evacuation of the fort, or, if refused, to, quote, proceed in such a manner as you may determine to reduce it, quote, meaning to take the fort. The next day, Beauregard sent Anderson an ultimatum to evacuate the fort and offered to allow the men to leave with their property and to have the flag saluted as it was being lowered. Anderson had conflicting orders at this point. One of the orders said that he should stay until the last extremity, but another said you should avoid useless sacrifices. Anderson turned down the offer. When a second round of offers was rejected, Anderson was told that firing would begin early the next morning. As the first rounds hit the fort, many observers atop Charleston homes lamented that Anderson was not returning fire, but Anderson was wise. He was waiting for daylight and better targets. Anderson had plenty of gunpowder, but he was short of cartridge bags, a critical resource. So Anderson reduced his cannon from 10 to 6, and that first day he also had to order men to fight at least 3 different fires inside the fort. In early afternoon, part of a rescue fleet, haphazardly organized by Gustavus Fox, appeared on the horizon of Charleston Harbor. In disarray, the relief ships did not enter the harbor. Shelling began at 7:30 a.m. the next day, and an early shell set off a major blaze at the fort. The fire was so intense that Anderson broke off defense, sending men to attend the fire. With the fort burning, the American flag had fallen from the tall mast in the middle of the fort. Since this was a sign to cease fire among many armies, the Confederates did in fact cease most of their fire. Eventually, Beauregard sent emissaries to see if Anderson would evacuate. After considerable discussion, there was agreement. The first battle of the Civil War was over. It had been fought between neighbors in a relatively small town and small harbor. It had been a battle between a teacher and a student. It was a battle 6 months in the making. Later that afternoon, Anderson's men fired a salute to the flag and were loaded on a ship to leave the harbor. As luck would have it, the tide let out just in time to leave the ship stuck in the sand near the fort all night long as the Confederates celebrated their victory. And what a victory it was.